Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Stuttered Kennedy. Chapter 41. London. On the morning of May 26, 1885, many people in London heard of Christian Science for the first time. The Times published a two-column article from a correspondent in Boston describing some of the phases of mental healing that had sprung up in the United States, but giving foremost place to Mrs. Eddy and the teachings of Christian Science. The Times in that year was moving forward under a new editor. Thomas Chenery, who had followed the great Delane, had died in 1884, and George Earl Buckle had succeeded to his chair in Printing House Square. Delane had, as used to be said of him, turned the favorite broadsheet of the English public into the leading journal of the world, and Buckle was eager to maintain the standard. Politics and war were Delane's great activities. Buckle, while maintaining the standard of his paper in these directions, sought also news of the more fundamental development in the realms of science and literature. The article published in the issue of May 26 was in every way a fair article. It recognized the fact that Christian Science differed from all other methods in that it had a definite theology and claimed to work on lines that could be understood and demonstrated. While it adduced several instances of healing and other positive testimony from people whose honesty and reliability, the correspondents declared, could not be gainsaid. The correspondent himself was, it is true, inclined to find his own explanations for the healings, but was quite clearly determined to be unbiased and present the situation as it was, as nearly as he could. He was, moreover, far from underrating the stir the new teaching was creating, and his description of a service he attended at Hawthorne Hall depicts a scene in interesting consonance with those described in earlier chapters of this record. Hawthorne Hall, where the Christian Scientists worship, is thronged for an hour before the time for service each Sunday. So eager are people to hear that after the standing room is all taken, people crowd around outside the doors, where they can catch only an occasional word or two. The service consists of ordinary devotional exercises preceding a sermon by Mrs. Eddy. The Times also had a leader or editorial on the subject, running to a full column in length. On the whole, like the original article, it is fair in its comments, but in the light of all that has happened since, it cannot be said to have caught a prophetic glimpse of the future. It regarded the letter from Boston as entertaining and attributed the success of mental healing in general and Christian Science in particular to the credulity of the Boston people, maintaining firmly that such things were to be expected from people who still retain a large share of fresh receptiveness of an earlier age. The Times article and leader aroused little interest. The flame flickered upwards for a moment and then went out again. It was 2 years before there was any further sign. Then, one day, a Mr. and Mrs. Graves Collis, who lived in the little village of Killiney, overlooking Dublin Bay, received a letter from a friend in the United States telling them about Christian Science, what it was, and what it claimed to do. It must have been a persuasive letter, for Mr. and Mrs. Collis acted promptly. They sent at once to Boston for a copy of Science and Health, and when it arrived, read it through with an increasing conviction that they had found something of which they had long been in search. So impressed, indeed, were they, that nothing would do but that they must cross the Atlantic to learn more about Christian Science from Mrs. Eddy herself. That was in the fall of 1887. A few months later, they were in Boston, and after several interviews with Mrs. Eddy, they arranged to enter the class she taught in the March of 1888, shortly before her journey to Chicago. It was, as may be remembered, a notable class, for the reason that so many of those enrolled in it afterwards became well known in the movement. Among them, General Erastus Bates, Edward A. Kimball, Hannah A. Larmony, Anna Dodge, and several others. The Collises seem to have developed a special regard for Hannah Larmony. Mrs. Larmony had studied with Mrs. Eddy 3 years previously, and when the March class was over, the Collises begged her to return with them to Ireland and commence the work in earnest in Dublin. Mrs. Eddy was consulted, and with her approval, the three set out on what was the first missionary journey of Christian Science beyond the shores of America. Reaching Dublin late in June, it was not long before Mrs. Larmony had established herself in offices at 40 Mount Pleasant Square. She seems almost at once to have secured a following, did considerable healing work, and taught at least one class. Mrs. Eddy, however, was eager that Christian Science should gain a foothold in London. In a letter to a friend several years later, she recalled that in the very earliest days of her work, as far back as 1868, she had remarked to a student that she felt sure she could introduce Christian Science in England more readily than in America. Indeed, a study of her letters shows that her thoughts turned constantly to England as a more than favorable field. At the time that Mr. and Mrs. Collis conferred with her as to the advisability of Mrs. Larmony's joining with them to make a start in Dublin, Mrs. Eddy seriously considered going to London herself in order to teach one or more classes. The turmoil which followed her return from Chicago and the momentous developments in the years immediately afterwards prevented her from carrying out her project. But as her correspondence with Mrs. Larmony clearly shows, she was in touch with the movement on the other side of the Atlantic all the time. Thus, in November 1888, she wrote to Mrs. Larminy in Dublin, urging her to extend her mission to London. Perhaps the chief reason actuating Mrs. Eddy at this time was the fact that several dubious versions of her teaching were already establishing themselves in London. Mrs. Larminy complied at once, for in December 1888, she writes to Mrs. Eddy from London that she is putting the dividing line between the false and the true, that the people may not be deceived. In the following year, another member of the March 1888 class, namely Miss Anna Dodge, at the instance of Mrs. Eddy, went over to London to help Mrs. Larminy and the Colleses, who had now left Dublin and lived in Monmouthshire, having a house also in London. All four seem to have been impressed with the extent to which false teaching had gained a foothold, and as shown by a letter from Miss Dodge to Mrs. Eddy, determined to take up the very wise position of carrying conviction to the outside world by their works, rather than by any enunciation of their faith. In other words, they set to work to heal the sick, thus beginning, as Mrs. Eddy had begun, and as all the most successful extensions of Christian Science had begun. Writing to Mrs. Eddy under date of September 1890, in a letter published in the October Journal, Miss Dodge said, "Let Christian Science do healing work here, seen and acknowledged, and it is established for all time. Consequently, I shall devote myself to healing and do no teaching at all for the present, further than to recommend the textbook to all." Miss Dodge later leased a house at 48 Stanhope Gardens, and it was in this house that the first public Christian Science services were held in England. They continued, however, only for a couple of months, and then the little group apparently decided once again that they should devote themselves simply to healing. As a consequence, 3 years passed before public services were held again. Then, finally, in the summer of 1896, the First Church of Christ Scientist of London was definitely established at 57 Bryanston Street and advertised its regular services in the journal. Shortly before this was done, Mrs. Collis and other members of the group had written to Mrs. Eddy asking her to send to them a teacher of recognized standing who could help them for a time in the work of establishing and expanding the church and teaching. In response to this request, Mrs. Eddy arranged with one of her students, Mrs. Julia Field King, to undertake the work, and so, early in the summer of 1896, Mrs. Field King sailed for England. She was, in many ways, a remarkable woman. Born on an Iowa farm, she early displayed a more than usual aptitude for study and ultimately went to Oberlin College in Ohio. There, After taking her baccalaureate degree, she studied medicine, practiced for 11 years, and taught in Chicago Medical College. She married early and was widowed within a few years, and then, in the early 80s, became interested in Christian Science through a lecture delivered by Emma Hopkins, who, it will be remembered, was one of the first editors of the journal. She went through a class with Mrs. Eddy in September 1888, and later settled in Seattle, where she quickly developed a large practice. From the first, she seems to have attracted the attention of Mrs. Eddy, who, early in 1891, invited her to come to Boston and assume the editorship of the journal. Mrs. Field King did good work, although, in the end, she suffered the fate common to the favorites. Her star was, for the moment, in ascendancy. She had been a successful practitioner in Seattle and also a successful teacher. She was, moreover, a cultured woman, well-versed in all social amenities. And so, taking her all in all, Mrs. Eddy evidently thought she would be a suitable woman to send as special envoy to London. This judgment was well-founded, for although at first disappointed with the situation, she wrote to Mrs. Eddy in the July of 1896 that the general thought in England was as far back as it was in the United States 15 or 20 years ago. Nevertheless, she seems to have achieved almost instant success as a teacher and in unexpected quarters. Christian Science in the United States had its beginnings among the humblest people. In England, it began rather among those at the other end of the social scale. The Earl and Countess of Dunmore, Sir Douglas Galton, Sir William Marriott, Colonel Hamilton, and many other well-known people became interested. All went well for a time, and then, in the winter of 1896, occurred one of those amazing onslaughts on the new teaching, which were so characteristic of the early days of its history. In November, Harold Frederick, the American novelist, died in London, and at the inquest it was shown that he had been attended by a Christian Science practitioner. In spite of the fact that Frederick had been treated by an Orthodox physician before he appealed to Christian Science for help, and was also under the care of a physician at the time of his death, the practitioner, a Mrs. Mills, was arrested and charged with murder. She was ultimately exonerated, but the case attracted a tremendous amount of attention. Such notoriety was bound to hamper in some degree the spread and prosperity of the movement abroad. Christian Science had not yet achieved a sustaining momentum in England, and Mrs. Eddy quickly made it plain that she considered the Frederick affair a serious setback. To Mrs. Field King, she wrote that students should never take a case of so doubtful a kind. And according to the report of Sue Harper Mims, the Atlanta teacher, she told her gift-minded students that she would rather have had the demonstration made in that home in London where Harold Frederick was than to have all the gifts on earth. Nothing in 20 years had harmed the cause so much, she insisted, since the survival of her doctrine depended wholly upon its healing works. By their fruits ye shall know them. In spite of these difficulties, the definite establishment of Christian Science in London and the extraordinary appeal it made to the people of culture and influence placed the movement finally on a recognized international basis. 10 years before, the Times had regarded it complacently as a rather naive product of a rather naive people. But from now on, as far as the outside world was concerned, the movement was able to point to a large and increasing number of adherents, drawn from all walks of life, from the highest to the most humble, on both sides of the Atlantic. As far as the elderly woman in Concord was concerned, there were times when a very human sense of satisfaction would reign for a moment, as when she wrote to her son George that lords and ladies, earls and princes, marquises and marchionesses came to see her or corresponded with her, that Hoke Smith declared she was the most illustrious woman on the continent, and that senators and congressmen sought her advice. But next minute, she had deflated her own balloon with the cryptic remark that she was not made the least bit proud by it or a particle happier. She goes calmly forward. In her letters, as in a few isolated cases in her writings, may be seen arising again and again the old Adam of the Baker heritage. Mark's terrible sternness with backsliders and unbelievers, his masterfulness and intolerance, his pride of place and family. But the course of final victory was all on the Ambrose side. Just as Abigail always won in her struggle with Mark, so the Abigail in her daughter, Mary, rode more and more to victory, until it was, in the end, completely triumphant. Mark comes out at times and suns himself, as in her short autobiography, Retrospection and Introspection, where she dwells for a page or two upon her family history and seeks to make the best and more than the best of her strangely failing son. She indulges it all for a moment, and then the Abigail and the Mary in her are found writing that it all amounts to just nothing at all. It is well to know that our material mortal history is but the record of dreams, not of man's real existence. And the dream has no place in the science of being. It is as a tale that is told, and as the shadow when it declineth. And then she adds, almost impatiently, mere historic incidents and personal events are frivolous and of no moment, unless they illustrate the ethics of truth. Her one thought now, more than ever, was the extension of the cause. And it may be ventured that the only abiding satisfaction she got out of the lords and the ladies, the senators and congressmen, was the evidence it all afforded of the progress of that cause. And so she writes, "I learned long ago that the world could neither deprive me of something nor give me anything. And I have now one ambition and one joy." And then, as if reflecting on even this, she adds, "But if one cherishes ambition unwisely, one will be chastened for it."